make a cycle of the Bart's head. That's a guess on my part. What do you think would happen if I ran that experiment? Where would be the greatest sensitivity of a single tone, sine wave, single generator that I slowly wave across that 6 megacycles? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
No, I think that's a good way to put it. Actually, they sell devices that essentially create interference and multipath and stuff like that for you to test your system with. You would see the maximum effect of that in terms of how the equalizer works, how hard the equalizer would work to control the delays that are occurring in each one of those taps. You would probably get the most disruption when you hit exactly on the pilot. If you were to raise it, it now will change the way the equalizer is working, but I don't think that because it's a single note that you would completely disrupt the decoding process in the receiver. Actually, there are other places where I think you would have more of a detrimental effect in terms of the decoding process, because there is some dynamic range. And as I said to you before, you can literally transmit the signal to a receiver without the pilot telling you.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So without the pilot tone, it would still separate data. Okay. If I want to be simple, I'm going to pick you up in a second, Joe. If I wanted to be super conservative, and I wanted to guarantee good reception, and I know that I've got enough signal-to-noise ratio, but I now am choosing the directivity of my antenna, the location of my antenna, and whatever, so that all co-channel interference is X number of dB down, and I want to have guaranteed demodulation on my medium quality of my equalizer in my particular decoder. That happens to be Radio Shack. In order to guarantee reception, would I have to almost guarantee that all co-channel interference digital television signals are more than 40 decibels weaker than the desired KE2EJ, K2RIW?
Yeah, that's actually a spec. I don't have it in front of me, but I think it's something like 30 or 35 dB down for everything to be really, really happy. The stuff will work with it being 20 dB down, but you'll be getting a lot of blocking and stuttering, and it won't be a solid reception. It won't be the brick wall kind of effect when you just don't have enough signal for it to separate data. But it wouldn't be a free-flowing stream that you would want to sit down and watch.
That's almost exactly what I'm seeing. I do see lots of audio blocking, occasional video blocking, occasional artifacts and whatever. And I've also discovered that the propagation changes from day to night are quite different. When I'm watching channel 5-1 versus 5-2, 9-1 versus 9-2, and there's a couple of other combinations, 50-1 and 50-2, 41-1 versus 47, I notice that in the morning I will see the odd ones, and in the evening I'll see the even ones better with less blocking, because they are on different frequencies. RF carrier frequencies. Therefore, I'm getting different amounts of demodulation. Okay, Joe and Wesley, in that order. Joe first, you've done a lot of experience with digital television DXing. Tell us what you've seen.
By the way, the -1 and the -2s are the same RF frequency, Dick.
Not on 9-1 and 9-2.
Yes, 9-1 and 9-2 are the same frequency. They're just different. They are just different packets in the stream. It's the same RF system, no difference.
Wow. And something's wrong with my demodulator, because it tells me that the identifier, 9-1 or 9-2, has a different RF frequency associated with it, and I can dial in that RF frequency, those two different RF frequencies, and I will see those two different channels. Are you sure?
C2QAQ in the comments, and a question for Eric.
Let me get it dropped. I'm 100% sure. Okay, originally, 5-1 was WNYW. 5-2 was the video from WWOR. 5-1 and 5-2 are on channel, RF channel 44. WWOR originally had 9-1, which is on channel, RF channel 38 or 33. I forget which one is which because they moved it around a little bit. And then 9-2 had WNYW. Whereas if the 5-1 was HD, the 9-2 was USD. Okay? The fact that the major channel number is associated actually with the RF carrier frequency, the dash number really is telling the receiver, or rather the receiver is being told what PIDs to pull out, PIDs or packet identifiers from that stream. For example, 21-1 is WLIW, 21-2 is 38, 21-3 is
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Your audio started failing on that transmission, Eric, go ahead. Ew, maybe I got a bad mic connected. Do you hear me? It sounds beautiful now, but your audio was slowly disappearing to zero. Oh, another radio to fix. Okay. You don't hear a crackling, do you? I was hearing crackling as the audio disappeared. It's clean now. I tightened up the mic connected.
21-1, 2, and 3 are all part of one 19.39 megabit stream. Think of it as one long shift register, okay? And the first 8 bits of the shift register would be putting out 21-1. The next 8 bits of the shift register would be putting out 21-2. The next 8 bits of the shift register would be putting out 21-3. So if you have a major channel number, which in the case would be 21, or it could be 9, or it could be 5, the major channel number is associated with the RF frequency. The sub-channel numbers really is associated with what packets are in the data stream.
Okay, I'm going to go along with that for the time being. I'm going to double check on this one. Right now, we've got Joe, Wesley, and Glenn in that order. Joe, W2RYY, straighten us out on this from your point of view, what you've seen, Joe. W2RYY, K2RYW in the second net.
Eric's right. He's absolutely right. All the dash stuff is all on within a particular RF channel. Whatever the RF channel is, the header is something else. That's not what I was going to ask you about. You were asking about interference. Last year, after all this stuff with digital, I did some experiments with putting a RF generator level signal into my CATV line, or the other TV line that feeds the house. And if I put the signal within 10 dB signal strength of the pilot carrier, I know you don't like that, but it's there. If I put the signal 10 dB or less of the pilot carrier, I would start getting pixelation of the picture. I could take the carrier and move it elsewhere without changing the level, and the pixelation would go away. I would have to increase the generator 5 to 6 dB to start getting the pixelation occurring again. Does that answer your question?
That's darn good information, Joe. And your measurement is a hell of a lot friendlier sounding. Although, what you're describing, which is similar to the experiment I was asking about, is a single tone being injected as it slowly waved across the 6 megacycles of the channel. When it's a real co-channel digital signal, I suspect that nowhere near that small number of dB of difference would be tolerable. I'm getting the impression that the Connecticut signal co-channel that I get from time to time, I'll bet you it's 15 or 20 dB down, but I still get the audio blocking and pixelation and all kinds of funny things going on, depending on which time of day and which channel I'm watching. So I think the system could be a bit more sensitive. I'm not thoroughly happy right now with digital television over-the-air broadcast. It's a little bit more troublesome. It's got nasty failure mechanisms. Let me drop it. Murphy's Law dictates you're watching some nice technical program. They're giving you all the background information. They're coming up to a bottom line. They're going to give you a beautiful piece of information. Just as they give you the beautiful piece of information, the audio gets blocked. Murphy's Law dictates it happens at the worst possible time. And you sit there and say, what did he say? Could I lip-read what he just said? Because the audio got blocked. and then sometimes you can't even lip read because even that gets pixelated. So whereas with analog television, I could tolerate some noise, I could tolerate some snow, some ghosting, whatever. The fact that the digital is so severe, it's either there or it's not there. And there's like a dB of difference between the two. From time to time, it's a little bit tough. Okay, we got two people with further comments, and then we'll come back and try to straighten this all out. Wesley was next, N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, N2XJN. Well, the original question was about the antenna, not really about how the signal is being done. And, of course, it is important, but it was giving the example of one antenna. It was not really investigated how to do it. I remember a picture from the old times when I was in Europe. I was playing with analog TV, and the amplifiers that were actually in the center of active component of the Yagi antenna. And, of course, you did have a drop of the signal through the coax, but as much as you had a drop of the signal, you had a drop of the noises in it. The thing is that my question is, what is the frequency span for all of the channels, and why the omnidirectional antenna is required? Because if you have a stack antenna or joystick antennas, they are responding to different frequency, and the amplification is being done in the antenna. Wouldn't that actually solve the problem?
You're asking, what is the frequency separation? Each of the channels are 6.000 megacycles wide. And we no longer have dead channels. We used to have only the odds and evens, so to speak, 2, 4, 5, 7, 9, 11, 13, in the New York City area. And all the channels in between were blank because there wasn't enough selectivity in the available tuners of that day.
With the bandwidth that it has, would be able to cover it, even though that incomfortability would be that you have to actually direct this antenna to the particular channel.
Yeah, Eric just told us it's called white space, and now they're no longer maintaining white space, or are they? Are they maintaining white space in metro areas right now, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
No, the thing that it is making you see blank channels, because you know that we have channel 44 and channel 45 that are right next to each other. We've got channel 21 and channel 20 that are right next to each other. There's going to be a channel 22. The thing that is driving the blank spaces is the location of service areas, where it's at, I can't remember, there's a number of channels that they have to be, I think they have to be 70 miles away or 80 miles away in order to be co-channel. So if it's closer than that, they won't allocate a frequency that's already in use in one area. There's got to be some separation.
Okay, let me take an example then. Assume that the separation number by FCC standards is 70 miles, and I just happen to be located midway between the two. I'm 35 miles from each channel. And if I'm not smart enough to use strong enough front-to-back ratio on my receiving antenna, aren't I going to be victimized by a pair of channels that are 35 miles apart? I'm on a high enough location that I'm getting good signal strength from each of those channels. Wouldn't I call that a co-channel interference problem to me? What would you, Eric?
No. The theory is that you have an antenna with good front-to-back ratio, and that there should be a reasonable amount of difference between the two signals. So, you know, you're oversimplifying the whole thing, because we have something called TELUS, which actually is a... not a pseudo-random number, it's actually a sequential code, so to speak, whereas when it locks on, it's looking for this sequence of numbers to create the decoding of the symbols, where it's actually an error correction scheme in terms of terrestrial broadcast. It also helps with multi-tap, and it helps with co-channel, so. But, you being in the location you are, sorry, you lose.
Okay, I see a problem here, though, Eric. Earlier you led me to believe something in the vicinity of 25 decibels of signal-to-noise ratio, of carrier-to interference, of a desired-to-undesired co-channel interference ratio is required to get moderate guarantee of good demodulation, 25 dB of, between the two. If I'm located midway between the two, that requires my antenna have to have 25 dB of front-to-back ratio. If I studied the available over-the-air broadcast television aerials that I can buy, and I did a serious test throughout most of their azimuthal plane, I think I would find very little locations where I can get 25 dB of front-to-back ratio. Therefore, for me, in a good location, I think I'm going to be in trouble. Over to you, Eric.
You're going to get dropping the sound, blocking the picture. I'm saying 25 dB is going to let the decoder work, but it's not. You're not going to have the brick, you know, the brick wall effect of having no signal at all. If you were to have a 35 dB difference between the two of them, you would probably get a nice, solid, continuous reception without any particular problems in it. 40 dB is going to be perfect. You know, the co-channel is going to have its effects on your decoder decoding continuously all the time.
I believe your numbers, but let me show you a problem. If I had the resources, and 5 years ago I had the resources, to set up a 28-foot parabolic dish antenna made by the D.S. Kennedy Company in Cohasset, Massachusetts. If I used a 28-foot diameter parabolic dish antenna aimed at Empire with an ideal feed horn feeding that dish, I could not guarantee 35 decibels of front-to-back ratio. Almost every antenna has back lobes that are only a couple of dB away from isotropic. Rarely, on a well-designed radar antenna, your back lobes are rarely more than, let me pick a number, 5 dB weaker than isotropic. The front lobe may be 28 dB above, but the back lobes are only a couple of dB below isotropic. You ain't going to get 35 dB of front-to-back ratio. Therefore, I almost cannot guarantee reception from the numbers you're giving me, Eric. K2EJ, K2RIW.
Well, all I'm telling you is that when you have co-channel and you see the co-channel signal, you're not going to be a happy camper, period. And the way they did allocate channels, there's that minimum distance between them. The fact that you're in the grade B, well, okay, you're in the grade B, you're not in the grade A. Actually, if you go to the FCC website, actually, let me do that right now. I'll tell you where the grade A ends. And in theory, you should be able to be in the grade A and not have an issue.
Okay, as you look that up, I'm going to go over to Glenn, who's been waiting patiently. KC2QIQ, you've done a lot of digital television reception. Tell us what you see, Glenn. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, very good, Dick. Just from listening here, I think what's happening right now, if I understand you correctly, you have an antenna with some fairly decent gain right now, but it's not on a rotator. Am I correct?
Give that man a cigar. No rotator yet, and it's not mounted high enough on the tower yet. When I get out from under a couple of other higher priorities, it's going to be a slightly better antenna with a rotator mounted another 70 feet higher than the current one. Back to you.
And let me ask you this question. When you set up this other antenna and you were doing it, did you have like a TV with you on the roof when you were like pointing this thing to make sure you got the best of all worlds between all the channels when you did it and just very, very carefully adjusted it? Or did you just kind of like put it up and tighten down the bolts and hope for the best?
It's worse than you pictured. The antenna itself is a Yagi-like structure. I'm guessing it's got 10-foot of boom length to it. Mounted on the chimney of the house, aimed directly at Empire State Building, put up 20 years ago, for over-the-air ordinary broadcast reception. I had another antenna at the 70-foot level of the tower, which has since blown down, and I've got to replace it. So this is a antenna, medium-gain antenna, medium-performance antenna, aimed directly at Empire, no fancy aiming. And the co-channels that I'm getting from places like New Jersey, Connecticut, maybe occasionally Massachusetts, maybe occasionally down the coast, are giving me a fair amount of grief. So the desirable direction for rotation is going to be different each day, each channel that I'm watching, and so on. I need a real adaptable rotator with a high-gain antenna at a high altitude to partially solve this problem. And even then, I think I'm going to some days have to carefully position a null
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Even then, on a particular channel, I'm going to have to occasionally carefully position a null in the antenna pattern toward the co-channel, or I'll be able to select one over the other, depending on which way I aim. But a lot of work is required on my part, because I'm strongly enthusiastic about over-the-air broadcast. It's just something about my nature. I have never bought cable TV, and I'm probably the only human being in my town that's still using over-the-air broadcast. My particular town has got 100,000 people. I can go up and down the block. I don't see an operational roof-mounted television aerial anywhere in my town. I'm the only one. Over to you, Glenn.
Okay, my first comment here is, I think overall, Dick, that you're making this problem a lot bigger than it really is. I think right now, just from the way you described the setup, that if you probably even just had a rotator and maybe replaced the coax with a really good RG6U and ran it down, nice length straight in, most of this problem would go away. The other thing, too, is probably just a little bit of experimentation with going up there, watching the TV a little bit, and move it, a couple of degrees to the right, a couple of degrees to the left. You might see a lot of stuff is going to clear up on its own just by doing that. Let me let it drop for a second, because I have another comment about the frequency spectrum.
RG6 SAT cable was replaced 6 months ago. Over to you.
Yeah, very good. I mean, that's a definite step in the right direction. I think also the rotator, you know, is even just where it's located now. And then, of course, then again, stepping up the antenna a little bit. But, I mean, if you really get up into the height you're talking about with a rotator and really good set of, RG6U coax, I don't think you're going to have a problem at all, Dick. Let me make a comment after this. This one was about frequency spectrum. And the thing here is, this is where I kind of have a question for Eric. I know that there's 6 megahertz bandwidth that's allowed for the broadcast spectrum for HDTV, or just digital television as we're calling it. But from what my understanding was that isn't it a digital multiplex, meaning that there is a pilot carrier that's on there where everything's referenced to that transmitted signal, and then to have the sub-channels that are within it. Yes, they're within the digital stream, within that 6 megahertz, but I believe that each segment, in other words, if you have a 9.1 and a 9.2, the digital data is that for each segment is actually on a delay from the pilot carrier in terms of its data stream. So they are being multiplexed at a certain ratio to the pilot carrier. So if that is really true, then you look at what that delay is. Technically, isn't that frequency difference from different portions of that 6 megahertz? I think it is. Let me pass it back to you, Dick, K2RIW, KC2QIQ, and then maybe Eric's got a comment on that one, because I think there is a frequency difference between them due to...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout.
I guarantee that those packets of the individual chunks of information are broken up in very complicated ways. Eric's going to clear that up for us. You got it, Eric.
Yeah, interestingly enough, the FCC is, we're sorry, the U.S. Census Bureau permanently ceased operation of its tighter mapping service, but I found an old map, and actually, you're outside the service area, Dick, so, you know, what can I tell you? All right, let me see, well, at least that's the Channel 13, I'll have to look at the other stations, but, you know, you're not in the Grade A area.
How far am I out of the Grade A area? And you're talking about 13 or 21? Over to you, Eric.
I'm talking about 13. You should be well within the service area 21.
Yeah, I am 4 LI miles from 21. Back in the days when my big array of 432 Yagis was working, if I listened to the channel 21 frequency coming out of my 432 antenna, I used to get approximately 0 dBm. I could almost rectify it and run a crystal radio. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, you shouldn't have a problem. What particular channel give you a hard time, by the way?
The other way around. It's more easy for me to count the channels that don't give me a problem. 7 never gives me a problem. 11 never gives me a problem. 13 almost never gives me a problem. 21 never gives me a problem. Everything else, 25 never gives me a problem. Although 25 itself periodically fails, even 21-3 had a failure recently where it had a sign saying, we're having technical difficulties, please stand by. A number of channels will periodically go into a technical difficulty mode where I know the signal is there, but the apparent signal-to-noise ratio graph goes down to zero. But except for those few that I've mentioned, all of my other, let me pick a number, 15 channels will from time to time give me audio blockage and pixelation at certain times of the day. Over to you, Eric.
Okay, well, let me tell you that Channel 7 is running, they're running about 35 kilowatts. They're the strongest station on the air in terms of RF signal strength. 11 and 13 are pretty much similar in output. They're both running about 4,700 watts. Channel 2 is just a little on the higher side. I think they're running 7,000. Actually, I can call up Tom, and he's got a gauge there that tells you what the power level of all the individual stations are. Not everybody has applied for maximization because of co-channel issues. The closest channel 13 is in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. So then they're running a megawatt, which is kind of unfair. But they managed to get the FCC to do that. And then there's some agreements between O&O stations in Connecticut and New York that are operating on the same channel where they basically tell the FCC, we agree to...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Yeah, 2 may be running a fierce amount of power, but I get blockage on 2 5% of the time, particularly when 60 Minutes is running. Sometimes it's rather frustrating. 13 has got a very characteristic operation to me. Whenever I dial in channel 13, any normal channel, the demodulator locks up and gives me picture in about 2 seconds. Channel 13 always takes 7, 8, 9 seconds before it locks up. I'm talking about 13-1. 13-2 and 3 don't do that. That's strange to me. Over to you, Eric.
Well, I can tell you why. 13-1 is actually the HD channel. It's doing something that we call long gop. It takes the receiver a little while to figure out from the P-chips what it actually is. So, I've been arguing with the folks there, but they don't want to listen, so forget that concept. But it also has to do with the encoding. It's not an RF issue, it's a stream issue. I think this thing is still timing out too soon. I'm going to download it, which is going to cause the repeater to be quiet for a minute, but I'll let you know when I'm going to do that. I just have to bring it up. Those issues are not RF issues, Dick.
I mean, it's worldwide.
Very good and glad to know. You got it, Joe.
Here's a simple question for you, Dick. And it's a yes or a no for an answer. Have you taken a spectrum analyzer and put it from 0 to 1,000 meg on your cable that's connected to your converter to verify the strongest signal in the neighborhood?
Absolutely not. I have the ability, haven't done it. Just haven't gotten around to that, Joe. And So you're saying I could be getting strong signals locally, and yes, there is a source of strong local signals. It happens to be 70 feet away. Oh, well. However, the other stronger signals in my neighborhood, I'm exaggerating when it comes to distance. When it comes to the stronger signals, I can tell when they're on the air. I haven't yet seen a correlation between those strong signals and my demodulation problems. I'm moderately sure that my problem is co-channel, and I strongly need a slightly better antenna, slightly higher location, and certainly a rotator. My guess is you're a hell of a lot happier having a rotator. Isn't that true, Joe? Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I am, Dick, but I don't have, I can leave the antenna antenna basically at 270, 275. I just let it sit there all the time. And I can watch newer channels, and I don't get pixelation or breakup. All right? Let me bring up a couple other points of things that may be causing you problems. Because right now you don't know, right? And for being a scientist, I just don't know how you're not knowing this. I would take a spectrum analyzer and verify what you have coming down that antenna cable, a stronger signal. Because these converters really do not like to get overloaded. I put a band, I guess it's a band, not a band stop. I put a filter, a low pass filter, that will basically stop everything, or start stopping everything above 750 megahertz. And it's got about a 50 dB drop by the time it gets up to 805, 806 megahertz. All right, and it knocks the cell site stuff down quite a bit. That was the thing, because I don't have any strong signals emanating in my neighborhood except for cellular stuff. But keep in mind, it may not be a cell site that's giving you the grief. It could be somebody on a cell phone operating at full power that's giving you the grief. That's one comment. Another thing is, you live in the flight path of Republic Airport. Planes coming and going on runway 1419 or taking off on the reverse runways going up north or so forth. These decoders really do not like multiband, especially from aircraft. I've noticed it a few times of mine. I'll get pixelation of the picture when I can hear and see a Southwest jet taking off from Islip MacArthur Airport, going west, and then hooking a turn and going south. When they do that kind of stuff, I'll get pixelation on some of the channels sometimes. Doesn't last very long, but it's there. So that's two comments I have to make about what you're doing there.
Okay, looks like we're back on the air. You've got one huge advantage over me, Joe. There is a hard back of mountain-like structure going down the spine of Long Island near the North Shore. That is a beautiful fence that blocks all of your co-channel interference that would be coming from the north, from Connecticut, Massachusetts, Rhode Island.
For a second, Dick.
Go ahead.
Hey, continue.
So you've got that beautiful fence that's protecting you from co-channel from the north. I live on that fence. Over to you, Joe. But you're absolutely right. There could certainly be a lot of cell sites in my neighborhood, a lot of cell phone operators. There's all kinds of sources of signal. And yes, it's time I put on a spectrum analyzer, as well as doing all these other things. Any further comments on this, Joe? Go ahead.
I would do the analysis of the spectrum analyzer first, just to make sure you don't have something really, really strong in the neighborhood or in the vicinity on a particular frequency that's overloading your converter. That's the first thing I do. Get that out of the picture as far as that. And then you work on the other things. I understand about living on top of the hill and on top of the ridge. I'm very familiar with that. And Hartford's right, not over the back of your antenna. They're sort of off like 40 degrees from you, from the back of your antenna. 45, something like that. They're not really off the back of them, between like the side of the back, all right? But they don't have a strong signal down here all the time. If I point the antenna at Hartford, even the channels that don't have co-channel interference, I can't get them from Hartford all the time. Too far for me because I got that ridge in the way. You, that's another story. So the spectrum analyzer thing would be different. You at least get that out of the way. And then if you when you're ready to buy a filter, I'll tell you where I got the filter that works good for me. That'll give you cutoff above 750 megahertz. They sell like a couple different models. The next model, lower than that, cut off at 650, and I really didn't want to do that because it would cut off the higher channels up to around 692. So the one I bought doesn't bother, it really has no effect on the TV channel up to 700 megahertz. There's really no rollover at all. The rollover starts above 750, so if that's what you're looking for, I'll tell you where to get that. It wasn't very expensive either.
SYL with a comment on aircraft. Bill recognized. And the filter you're using is giving you a lot of improvement on strong signals from 800 meg cell sites and above. However, you probably know AT&T, I guess it was, just spent a small fortune for the frequencies between 700 and 800 megs, the so-called LTE band. And so all of those cell sites are in the process of coming online as we speak. And I think there's a strong push to have them all operational by the end of this year, because cell phones will be sold with that capability. So the filter you've got, maybe you're going to have to go to the next higher model number, so to speak, and I'm going to have to do that too. Over to you, Bill. KC2SYL, K2RIW on the TechNet.
This is KC2SYL. Dick, have you looked at the map of Google Earth to see your correlation and distance between you, LaGuardia Airport, and the Empire State Building? I suspect your interference may be related to the runways that are used at LaGuardia, and I'll explain why. I live very close to LaGuardia, about 4 miles near the Throgs Neck Bridge, and I can actually see the difference when I'm on 2 meters, but the signal changes. Very minor, but I can notice it. I suspect that it may be related to the aircraft that are using specific runways at specific times, and I could give you some hints on how to determine that. Back to you.
LaGuardia Airport is almost in line between me and Empire. I don't know the exact number, but if I had to make a guess, it's probably within 10 degrees of the bore site of Empire. And my antenna is probably 40 degrees wide, so LaGuardia is in the main lobe of my antenna that's looking at the Empire. So what's coming from LaGuardia that's giving me extra grief here, Bill? Go ahead.
Two possibilities. There are two runways. There's actually four runways at LaGuardia, 1331 and 422. And the way runways are set, they're compass headings. The 422, runway 4 is north, basically. That would be 40 degrees. Runway 22 would be facing south, the southwest. The other runway is 130 degrees, and 31, 310 degrees. Over Long Island Sound, there is an approach to runway 22, which is a southwest runway, that actually comes over Long Island Sound, crosses over City Island, and I suspect that it may be reflections from the aircraft, and maybe not reflections, but obstructions. Similarly, for runway 4, which is the 180 degree difference from runway 22 on takeoffs, when the planes climb out, that may interfere with your signal, especially if you have a 40 degree aperture on your receiving antenna. The runway 13 and 31, I don't think would be that much of a effect, because they would be going south and north and off the compass. Thank you.
EC2QIQ with a comment.
Glenn recognized, and Bill, I think you've hit something here. I used to do a whole lot of communicating with K4CAW on 432 megacycle down to Greensboro, North Carolina, 480 miles. And when any aircraft was midway between us at 30,000 feet, the signal would increase by 30 decibels. So aircraft reflection in a bistatic, or it's a multipath reflection off the bottom of an aircraft at a grazing angle, can give you a huge signal strength increase. And so I could be getting multipath from aircraft to Empire as well as direct to Empire, and those two signals are beating against each other, and one of them is moving at 300 and some odd miles an hour. So that could be a strong contributing factor. and the rate at which the aircraft moves, is that within the range of timing at which the adapter section can readapt itself? That's an interesting question. KC2QIQ, K2RIW, you got it, Glenn.
I don't know, Dick. If you look at where my QT, home QTH is here, and where I'm located with respect to Empire, Channel 13, and everything else, and you come by here and take a look at my WineGuard antenna, it's at about 23 feet in the air, just poking, barely skimming the top of my roof, hanging up over the top. It's got the poorest location of any of my antennas, and I poke it right basically in the direction towards Empire, and I get 13 and just about everything that's out there. And if you look at where JFK is for my home QTH and LaGuardia is, and the flight paths, they come in, especially at like 10 o'clock, I get zero interference whatsoever. But I can say the one thing that I had to do before I got to the, and there's no rotator on my antenna, by the way, either, but all I did was I just had to spend a little bit of time finding the optimal direction of the antenna before I really tightened it down. I had to play around and move it around a little bit to the left, a little bit to the right, and eventually everything cleared up, and because I did experience a lot of things you were talking about, but it was just a little bit of tinkering the antenna back and forth, and then finally all of it went away. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, and I'm guessing your antenna ended up with the bore site very close to Empire. I do remember being at Eric's place of business at one time, and he's got a rotatable television receiving antenna on the tower. And he would see significant improvement in performance of a converter as he rotated the antenna. So from time to time, there are specific angles for specific channels where when you rotate, things get better. Am I correctly describing what I think I remembered, Eric? K2EJ, if you're there, K2RIW on the TechNet. Okay, Eric's not available right now. Go ahead, Wesley.
Want to thank you for your email. I'm just looking at it. It's absolutely fascinating material that you have sent me, showing what the impedance phase analyzer could do in this particular situation for measuring the frequency characteristic of the capacitor. And I have a manual already. I printed today close to 460 pages. But this example you have sent me is a practical one. Thank you very much.
Okay, glad that that helped. It did look kind of good. It looks like it was an additional piece of information, helping students that are learning how to use those particular instruments. And looks like you're going to have some fun with that thing. Of the people who signed in tonight, I hope we didn't skip anybody who had questions. Please speak up right now and give us your call letters and name. K2RIW on the TechNet. Okay, there being none, I'm going to re-mention Bernie usually likes us to mention, in case there are people in the outlying areas listening. You're listening to TechNet number 1307 of the series that began in September of 1982, I think it was, 27 and a half years ago. And it's a gathering of people who like discussing electronics, wireless electronics in particular, ham radio usually, but not always, in the New York City area of the United States. If we've run out of questions and comments, let me pass it over to Mel. Although it's beyond the normal hour where we answer email, there may be an email of a more senior person that you want to cover, or there may be another subject that you think we should cover. K2KEY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
No, this is K2KEY. A couple minutes early tonight, we run over. So no, it's no use delving into any of this because most of it I've boiled down to questions that be of interest to especially the newcomers to ham radio, and the other ones are some questions, comments, and all are long, sort of long-winded nature that I have to just scan over, and unfortunately I can't do much with them. Some of them are really detailed, very detailed questions. I think we sort of covered that before, that we can't just delve into that type of, first of all, wouldn't be of much interest to him, to the TechNet as far as I'm concerned, to take over.
And it's a bit of a problem in that people will listen to Mel and I and say, gee, you guys seem to know a lot about electronics, wireless electronics in particular, and I've got this problem. And they mail us an email. Well, we've never volunteered to do written, free consulting. And that's not what we volunteered for. Particularly when it comes to people who are just learning ham radio, we like to help them out. But although it's an extremely nice compliment, there are times when people will send Mel and me their patent application, their college homework, their doctoral thesis material. Oh, we get some really heavy stuff. and people would like us to review that for them, and they comment, and, you know, send them back 10 pages of typing as to what we think should be changed. They'd like a technical review. Well, that's quite a bit beyond the call of duty. On top of that, there are a certain number of people out there that are angry at us that they sent us an email and they didn't get an answer. Let me drop. There are times when Mel is getting hundreds of emails in one single week. That's way beyond what is reasonable for any one human being on a voluntary service to try to handle. So if you didn't get an answer, you're not being singled out. We're not trying to tell you something, but you know, you got the wrong mouthwash or whatever. So be careful. We're doing the best we can with limited resources. I think we're going to end a little bit earlier than normal tonight. As I said, this was TechNet number 1307. I hope I didn't skip the numbers on the previous page. That looks like I got it right. And on the assumption that we stay healthy, we'll be back next week trying to do more of the same. And good luck with all your RF circuits and all your television watching and all of your experiments. The world of radio is kind of magical. You'd be amazed how much non-understanding there is. For instance, the previous issue of QST magazine, let me drop, had a beautiful article which covered the subject to a slight degree with a beautiful diagram of circular polarization. And although it was reasonably well researched by a very qualified person who wrote the article, it's backwards. What's called clockwise is a counterclockwise wave. I wrote them a letter, gave them the references. They admitted, yes, an error has been admitted, occurred. Unfortunately, they think it's a fine detail, and I think it's not going to be corrected. Unfortunately, multiple people have seen that diagram. It's burned in their memory, and they're going to go on for generations thinking that. Correspondingly, if I study a inductor-capacitor parallel resonant circuit, and if I figure out what happens during the sine wave of signal that's across that inductor and capacitor that are in parallel and they're operating at the resonant frequency, you will rapidly discover that the energy at one instant time when the voltage is peak, let me drop, when the voltage is at a peak, positive peak or negative peak, almost all of the energy is stored in the capacitor and the current through the inductor is going through zero. There's no magnetic field on the inductor. A quarter of a cycle later, the current is maximum, the voltage is going through zero, and all of the stored energy is in the inductor. So in a parallel LC circuit, the energy is bouncing back and forth four times per cycle between the inductor and the capacitor. Okay, now you take a free space radio wave where the inductance or the magnetic field is, let's say, vertically polarized, and the E field is horizontally polarized because this is a horizontal wave propagating in space. Probably one quarter of all of radio savvy mankind believes that the magnetic energy, the vertically polarized magnetic energy, and the horizontally polarized electrostatic energy, electronic energy, that it is oscillating back and forth in that propagating wave. One quarter of humanity that's savvy in radio frequency circuits believes that. It's dead wrong. Let me drop. You dig deep enough and you go to the right reference. You'll find out that at the instant the H field is maximum, at that instant of time, and at that point in space, at that exact same point in space, at that exact same instant of time, the E field is also maximum. E and H both go through maximum at the exact same time. They both go through zero at exact same time. If you could see the E field and the H field as a spherical object, each individual half wave is a ball-like structure moving through space at the speed of light. And they're individual multiple balls, like beads on a string, moving at the speed of light. And in between each one of these balls, there is an absolute null of E and H simultaneously. The pointing vector tells you that in order to calculate the direction of propagation of the signal, you use the cross product, vector cross product, of crossing E into H. E and H must be simultaneously present for that cross product to exist. If one hit peak when the other hit zero and vice versa, there would be no clearly defined unidirectional pointing vector. There would be no determination of which way the signal propagates. So good common sense of taking a parallel inductor and capacitor and trying to relate it to a wave propagating in space will lead you astray. You'd be amazed how many things like that exist. And those diagrams, with erroneous diagram, exist in a couple of fairly well-respected books. I can show you websites to try to correct this. So, not more to it than first meets the eye. Send me through, you all. Be kind to each other. We'll see you next week. K2KEY for any other comments. K2RAW in the tech man.
Well said, Dick. KC2QIQ.
Thank you, Glenn. You got it, Mel.
Exactly. This is K2KEY. I was explaining that to a couple of people on 75 meters, and well, the response was, forget it. I could say, because it is in some prestigious writings of the past, it has become gospel, and no use fighting it. I just give up a lot of times. I say, well, I just can't, convince you, so I just say, well, I just surrender, unfortunately. Okay, with that, 73 to everybody. And as Dick says, if all goes well, we'll do it again next week. Take care, and thank you for joining us. And as far as emails are concerned, try to keep them brief, and I will try to bring up whatever is, apropos for the TechNet. Good night. This is K2KEY.
Hey, good night, Dick. Thank you very much again.
Good night, Dick and Mel, and all the other contributors that helped me out with my antenna question and my wallwart question. This is Bill, KC2SYL. Have a great week, and look forward to participating in a net next week.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Thank you. 87DAW, listening. This is 87DAW, listening via Echolink.
K7DAW, K2JHR.
K2JHM, K7DAW, good morning, Tom here.
Good morning, K7DAW, here is K2 Juliet Hotel Romeo, good morning. And here's Joel, J-O-E-L, just happened to hear you up on frequency and into the Apple link. Again, good morning.
Hey, Joe, nice to hear you out there. Just figured I'd put it on here for a little bit. I'm on Echo Link, using a laptop with a hand mic, and actually running the audio back through a computer radio through a special audio connection. So I was looking to feel the radio without being in the, on the radio, so to speak. Anyway, I'm in Port St. Lucie, Florida. Where are you?
Currently approximately 1¾ miles south of the Empire State Building in Manhattan.
Oh, okay. Yeah, very good. Very good. Hey, sounding good, over there. I'm originally from Long Island. Grew up on the North Shore near Oyster Bay in a town called Bayville.
Yes, I know that area very well. I spent a lot of time in Bayville. I know it well.
I saw the radar, sometime this afternoon, I guess. You had some showers and thunderstorms go through there. Anything noteworthy or just passing showers?
Parts of the North Shore and center of Long Island, Pacific, and Nassau County did clock wind speeds in excess of 60 miles per hour, and a lot of heavy rain, but it went through at a speed of about 45 miles per hour.
Okay, so not enough time to do any damage, I guess, or if so, isolated damage, I would guess. Yeah, that was moving pretty good. And I guess from looking at the forecast up there, because I do that quite a bit, I guess it says that you guys are going to be in the mid to upper 80s now for most of the week. So that's better than the mid to upper 90s, I guess. We get about 93, 94 here every day with the humidity. So that's one of the disadvantages of living in the state of Florida. Especially when you grew up up there where you get the seasons and you get a little more moderate or temperate summers than down here, Roger.
Well, you do have the opportunity to possibly move up further in the state, possibly up toward the northeast quadrant. So that would be St. Augustine, or that would be north of that area, because you do tend to get a little bit more seasonal change than you do in Port St. Lucie, where I have been a number of times.
Oh, yeah. I've been down here since 2003. So basically, actually going on 7 years down here. Started out in Pembroke Pines, which is down near Lauderdale. And didn't like that at all. I mean, you know, too much congestion. I like the suburban, rural kind of living more than city kind of living. And living down there is like living in Queens. And, I wouldn't want to live there either. Everybody lives where they live, I guess, you know. So anyway, we came up here. It's much nicer. We got some pine trees and a preserve in the backyard here. The deer that run through here every once in a while, a lot of raccoons and what have you. Got a bobcat that comes in every once in a while too. that's a lot different than the iguanas and the lizards and all that stuff down there a little further south, down there in the port, in the Lauderdale.